Have you ever looked at the world of finance and, you know, sort of wondered why Canada's biggest banks often seem like these impenetrable fortresses? They just seem immune to the kind of big shifts that can really shake up banks elsewhere.
It's a really interesting point, isn't it? And it cuts right to the core of what makes the Canadian economy, well, tick differently.
So today, we're diving deep into this fascinating world of Canada's big six banks. And this isn't just about, like, looking at numbers on a page.
No, not at all.
It's about understanding the actual backbone of a whole national economy. It's shaped by these unique regulations, specific market dynamics, and honestly, a surprising amount of global reach.
That's right. When you look at Canada, these banks, they operate with a fundamentally different structure, a different role compared to, say, the big players down in the U.S. or over in Europe. Mm. They really are pillars of stability. And our mission today really is to help you understand why that is, what forces are shaping them right now in 2025, and crucially, what does it all mean for you, whether you're, you know, an investor, maybe a homeowner, or just someone curious about the economic currents.
And to guide us, we've gathered a pretty extensive stack of sources for this deep dive. We're talking detailed financial analyses from big names like S&P Global, Morningstar, DBRS.
The heavy hitters.
Exactly. Plus reports straight from the Bank of Canada, insights from OSFI, that's the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions, a huge player here.
Absolutely critical.
And even perspectives from Deloitte and JD Power. Our goal is to pull out the most important bits of knowledge, helping you grasp not just what these banks are up to, but why they operate the way they do.
And what's really striking is how they balance these huge structural advantages. You mentioned the oligopoly, that tight market, and the super stringent regulations creating this deep economic moat.
Right, that fortress idea again.
Exactly. How they balance that with some very real, very significant near-term risks. We're talking about rising U.S.-Canada trade tensions, a slowing domestic economy, and something called the normalization of credit quality. Things getting back to normal after being unusually good for a while.
And we also need to unpack the Bank of Canada's expected rate cuts, which sounds good, but maybe isn't always straightforward.
It's a bit of a double-edged sword, as we'll see. There are definite positives, but also some potential negatives for the bank's bottom line.
Okay, so the big takeaway from our sources seems to be, despite some choppiness ahead, some real headwinds, their underlying long-term stability and track record for consistent returns, well, it makes them a cornerstone for a lot of people's portfolios.
That's the general consensus, yes. Despite the near-term noise, the foundation is seen as remarkably solid.
All right, let's really get into it then. Let's unpack this. Okay, let's start right at the foundation. This idea of Canada's banking system being like a fortress, it really does seem unique globally.
You're absolutely right to start there. The foundational idea is that Canada's banking system operates within one of the world's most robust and, maybe more importantly, most conservative regulatory framework.
Conservative meaning cautious.
Cautious, prudent, focused on stability above all else. And this isn't just a detail, it's the defining feature. And it's all overseen meticulously by OSFI, the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions.
So OSFI, how do they actually make these banks so strong? What are the specific rules or mandates that create this sturdiness?
Well, the absolute cornerstone is capital adequacy. OSFI requires the six largest banks, they call them domestic systemically important banks, or DSIBs, to hold these incredibly substantial capital buffers.
Buffers against what, exactly?
Against unexpected losses. Think of it like a giant financial shock absorber. For example, there's something called the Domestic Stability Buffer, the DSB. It's currently set quite high at 3.5% of their risk-weighted assets.
Okay, 3.5%. What does that mean in practice?
It means banks must set aside a significant chunk of capital, pure loss-absorbing capital, specifically to handle tough times, financial stress. And it's not just theory. It means they have exceptionally strong capital positions right now.
How strong are we talking?
As of the second quarter of 2025, the average Common Equity Tier 1 ratio, that's a key measure, CET1 for these DSIBs, stood at a very healthy 13.6%.
And how does that compare internationally?
It's significantly higher than many global peers. It means Canadian banks are designed fundamentally to avoid the kind of domino effect, that financial contagion we've unfortunately seen happen in other markets.
Okay, so they've got this deep pool of capital ready for a rainy day.
Yeah.
What about just making sure they have enough cash for day-to-day operations, especially if things get rocky?
That's the liquidity side. OSFI is constantly refining rules here, too. They have ongoing tweaks to liquidity adequacy requirements, the LAR guideline, and internal processes the banks must follow, called ILAB. It's all designed to make sure banks can meet all their obligations, paying out deposits, funding loans, even in really challenging, unexpected scenarios. It's about preventing a cash crunch.
And this isn't just Canada saying, hey, we're great, right? Others agree?
Precisely. You look at the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. Their 2025 Financial System Stability Assessment, basically a big health check, concluded Canadian banks are, and I quote, well-positioned to withstand severe solvency and liquidity shocks.
Wow, that's a strong endorsement.
It's a powerful, independent validation of the system's toughness.
Okay, so we've got these tight rules, high capital, strong liquidity, IMF approval. But for our listener, whether they're a customer, an investor, or just trying to understand the economy, what does all this actually mean?
This is where it gets really interesting. Because these strict regulations, they do something profound.
Mm-hmm.
They create what economists call a nearly insurmountable economic moat.
A moat, like a castle.
Exactly like a castle. Think drawbridges up, deep water all around. It's an immense barrier preventing new competitors from easily entering the market and challenging the big players.
So it locks in the existing structure.
Pretty much. It solidifies this oligopolistic market where the big six control over 90% of all banking assets in Canada. 90%.
Wow. So effectively, very little real competition at the very top. That must give them some serious advantages.
It absolutely does. That lack of intense competition at the top ensures remarkably stable profits for the big six. For investors, this structure is a key reason why Canadian banks have historically traded at a higher valuation, a premium, compared to many international banks.
And safer too, presumably.
Much safer. It's why they've largely avoided the kind of systemic blow-ups we've seen in more fragmented markets, like parts of the U.S. regional banking sector recently. For you, the investor, it offers a unique sense of security.
But is there a downside for the average Canadian?
There can be. While your money is undoubtedly safer, this lack of cutthroat competition might mean fewer innovative product choices sometimes, or perhaps fees that aren't as competitive as they might be, in a market with more disruptors constantly snapping at their heels.
That makes sense. But surely, all this safety comes at a cost. All those regulations, the capital they have to hold, the compliance teams, it must be incredibly expensive for the banks to maintain.
You've hit on the crucial trade-off. Yes, compliance costs are significant. They require massive investments in tech, in people, in controls. But those costs are essentially the price of stability.
A deliberate choice, then.
A very deliberate choice. Higher operating costs in exchange for a banking system that's incredibly resilient, deeply trusted by the public, and frankly, fundamentally unlikely to face the kind of existential crises we've seen play out elsewhere.
Okay, so that's the strong foundation, the fortress. But even fortresses face changing weather, external pressures. What are the key economic headwinds and maybe monetary tailwinds these banks are dealing with in 2025?
Well, the biggest headwind right now, the dominant dark cloud, is the significant uncertainty coming from escalating trade conflict with the United States.
That sounds serious. How's it playing out?
Our sources are clear. It's caused a sharp drop in business confidence across Canada. Many companies are putting big investment plans on hold, pausing hiring, developing contingency plans, just waiting to see how things unfold.
So real caution setting in.
Deep caution. This uncertainty is truly the most material downside risk to the sector right now. It could really dampen loan growth, and if it gets severe enough, it could potentially tip the Canadian economy into a mild recession.
That's definitely concerning. Is there anything pushing back against that? Anything positive happening on the economic front?
Yes, there is a very significant tailwind providing some counterbalance. The Bank of Canada's monetary policy, they've turned decidedly dovish.
Dovish meaning cutting interest rates.
Exactly. Facing a weaker economy and inflation that's moderating, the BOC has started a clear rate-cutting cycle. Our sources project the main policy rate could fall from its peak of 5.0% in 2024 all the way down to maybe 2.25% by the end of 2025.
Wow, that's a big drop. How does that help?
Well, this monetary easing is designed to stimulate the economy, right? Get people borrowing and spending. For the banks, though, it creates this dual impact. You called it a double-edged sword earlier, and that's a good way to think about it.
Okay, let's take the good edge first. What's the benefit?
On the positive side, lower rates should definitely spur loan demand, especially mortgages. It makes housing more affordable, which is a big deal in Canada.
Right.
And crucially, lower rates also provide much-needed breathing room for households that are heavily indebted. This should help stabilize credit quality, preventing a big spike in loan losses. So good news for borrowers and good for the bank's loan books overall.
Okay, that sounds like a clear positive. What's the other side of the sword then, the less favorable edge for the banks?
The other edge is that when rates fall rapidly, it typically compresses something called net interest margins, or NIMs.
NIMs, that's basically their profit margin on lending, right?
Exactly. Think of it like a store's markup. Banks earn money on the spread, the difference between the interest they charge on loans, their selling price, and the interest they pay out on deposits, their cost of goods.
Okay.
When market rates fall fast, banks have to lower the rates on new loans pretty quickly to compete, but the rates they pay you on your savings account, those tend to fall more slowly. Deposits are stickier.
So their costs don't drop as fast as their prices.
Precisely. It's like your wholesale costs staying high while you're forced to have a sale. It squeezes that profit margin on each loan they make.
So the central question for bank profits in 2025 really comes down to this balance. Can the Bank of Canada's rate cuts boost the economy enough, get enough new loans flowing to offset the drag from trade uncertainty and this potential squeeze on their margins?
That's the core dynamic. The bank's earnings reports this year will be a direct real-time indicator of how resilient the Canadian economy actually is in this tricky environment. It's a critical thing to watch.
And just quickly, what are the headline economic forecasts for 2025 from your sources?
Sure. Canada's real GDP growth is expected to pick up a bit to maybe 1.7%. The unemployment rate is forecast to peak around 7.0%. Inflation, the CPI, is expected to get back down to the Bank of Canada's target, around 2.1%.
And housing?
A modest national home price correction is expected, maybe down about 2.0% nationally for the year. So, cooling, but not crashing.
Okay, that sets the macro scene clearly. Now, let's pivot to something absolutely central to Canadian banks, the real estate market. It always feels like both a potential vulnerability and something with unique protections here.
It absolutely is both. Canada's big six are deeply, deeply tied to the national housing market. Residential mortgages make up a huge chunk of their loan portfolios.
Which makes high household debt a worry.
It makes high household debt, particularly mortgage debt, a key systemic vulnerability. It's just a structural reality of the Canadian financial system.
And the outlook for housing in 2025? You mentioned a modest price dip?
Yeah, the outlook is definitely one of cooling. Not a collapse, but cooling. That forecast is for about a 2% national price decline. We've already seen resale markets soften quite a bit, especially in places like Ontario and BC that were really hot before.
Buyers getting cautious.
Buyers, developers. Everyone's taking a more wait-and-see approach. Now, while a big crash isn't the base case, this softer market is expected to lead to a normalization of credit losses.
Meaning more people missing mortgage payments.
Exactly. We expect mortgage delinquencies to rise from the incredibly low levels we saw recently, but, and this is key, the forecast suggests they should remain manageable and not spiral into a crisis.
What about commercial real estate? Offices, malls, that sort of thing? There have been worries elsewhere, especially with remote work.
Yeah, the commercial real estate, or CRE, sector definitely faces its own challenges. The office segment, in particular, is feeling the effects of remote work sticking around.
But how exposed are the big Canadian banks?
Our sources suggest their direct exposure to the trickiest parts, like downtown office towers, seems relatively contained, certainly less concentrated than some big U.S. banks, for example.
Okay, so there's this undeniable link, this vulnerability to housing. But you mentioned mitigating factors. There's something specific OSFI does, right? The stress test. Guideline B20.
This is absolutely crucial for understanding why the system is expected to hold up. Since 2018, OSFI's guideline B20, which includes this tough mortgage stress test, has been fully in effect.
How does that work again?
Essentially, when you apply for a mortgage, you have to qualify not just at the actual interest rate you'll pay, but at a rate significantly higher, often 2% higher, or a minimum floor rate, whichever is greater.
So they test you for a tougher scenario than you'll actually face initially.
Exactly. It's like making sure you can lift 100 pounds even if you only plan to carry 70 day to day. It builds substantial payment buffer into the loan right from the start.
And the impact of that?
The impact is huge. A very large portion, the majority of the mortgages currently on the bank's books were originated under these stricter rules. It provides a critical layer of resilience that simply wasn't there in previous downturns. It's a built-in shock absorber for the system.
That sounds like a really effective safety net. But even with that, is there still a pocket of risk in the mortgage market? Where's the main concern now?
The primary area of risk, the group everyone's watching closely, is borrowers who took out mortgages right at the peak of the low interest rate period, say 2020 to early 2022.
Why them specifically?
Because they are now, or will soon be, facing mortgage renewal at substantially higher interest rates. This can lead to significant payment shock.
Meaning their monthly payments jump way up.
Potentially, yes. For many families, that's not just a financial term. It's a real stress point, a major hit to their budget. These are the households that need the most careful monitoring, and you can be sure the banks are doing just that.
Okay, so we've laid out the solid foundation in the current economic weather. Now let's look ahead. The whole banking world is going through this massive digital shift, and Canada's no exception. That must bring huge opportunities, but also big challenges.
Absolutely. The core idea here is that Canadian banking is right in the middle of a profound digital transformation. It's being pushed hard by what consumers want, how they want to bank, and also by the constant pressure from these nimble fintech disruptors.
So the big six aren't just sitting back.
Far from it. They are actively defending their turf. We're talking billions, literally billions of dollars being invested in technology modernization.
Billions is a huge number. What exactly are they spending it on? Where's the focus?
A major focus, according to our sources, is the deep integration of artificial intelligence, AI. They're not just playing around with it, they're using AI across the board.
How so?
To boost efficiency behind the scenes, to personalize customer experiences, much more think-tailored offers and advice, and critically, to get much better at detecting fraud.
Any specific examples?
Yeah, sources mentioned things like CIBC building its own in-house generative AI platform or TD rolling out something called TD AI Prism. These aren't just fancy names. They show a clear strategic bet on using technology as a key weapon, both defensively and offensively, to keep their market share.
So it's way beyond just having a slick mobile app. It's about changing the core operations. And aren't there some big industry-wide changes coming, too, around how payments work and how data is shared?
Yes, very much so. A really pivotal development for the whole sector is the long-delayed modernization of Canada's payment systems. Mm-hmm. This includes rolling out the real-time rail, or RTR.
Faster payments, basically.
Instantaneous payments, yes. And alongside that, implementing an open banking framework. Now, there have been delays, which maybe accidentally gave the big banks more time to get ready, but when these systems finally launch, they're expected to significantly ramp up competition across the whole financial sector.
How will they increase competition? What's the mechanism?
It really comes down to data. Open banking will allow you, the consumer, to more easily and securely share your financial data with other approved companies, think agile fintechs like Wealthsimple or Kehoe.
So I could let a budgeting app see my bank transactions easily.
Exactly. Or let a different company analyze your spending to offer you a better loan rate. This ease of data sharing means new innovative services can pop up much faster, potentially pulling customers away from the traditional banks for specific things they do well, like maybe investing or getting a small loan.
And this is seen as important for Canada overall.
Absolutely. Business leaders see getting this modernization done as critical for Canada's competitiveness on the world stage in this global digital economy. There's a real sense of urgency now.
Okay, so massive tech spending by the banks, plus new infrastructure potentially opening the door to more competition. What does this mean for the bank's bottom line, their profitability?
Well, these huge and frankly non-negotiable tech investments, they act as a persistent drag on improving efficiency ratios. Banks aren't just spending to get ahead. They have to spend heavily just to keep up, just to meet customer expectations and stay competitive.
So it eats into profits.
It means their expense base is high and sticky. So even if they grow revenues nicely, getting significant improvements in operational efficiency, which is normally a key way banks boost earnings, that's going to be really challenging in the medium term. It's like a continuous, expensive tech arms race.
Okay, beyond the economy and tech, what other big consolidated risks are the big six facing? Let's maybe circle back to credit risk first.
Credit risk definitely remains front and center. The main worries are still those high levels of Canadian household debt and the bank's big exposure to a cooling housing market.
Even with the stress test.
While underwriting has been prudent, a sharper than expected recession could still lead to a meaningful jump in mortgage and consumer loan defaults. And as we touched on, there's also growing scrutiny of their commercial real estate exposure, especially for banks with big U.S. footprints like BMO and TD, particularly in that challenged U.S. office market. That's definitely something analysts are watching closely now.
Okay, so credit risk is number one. What about operational risks? Things going wrong inside the bank.
This is a huge category covering a lot of ground. But the most prominent and persistent threat here is cybersecurity. A major cyber attack wouldn't just cost a lot of money. It could cause devastating reputational damage that takes years, maybe decades, to fix.
And compliance risk, following all the rules.
That's another big one. The cost of just keeping up with regulations is huge and always increasing, and the consequences of getting it wrong are severe. Just look at the recent, very public case of TD. They're facing multi-billion dollar penalties for failures in their anti-money laundering, or AML, controls down in the U.S.
It was huge news.
It's a stark, very expensive reminder. It's not just a fine. It can impact their ability to grow, their strategic options, everything. Getting compliance wrong has massive consequences.
That TD situation really underscored the stakes. What about strategic risks? Long-term threats to their actual business model? What keeps the bank CEOs up at night?
The biggest long-term strategic risk, the existential one perhaps, is the potential for technology to slowly, gradually erode the structural advantages of the oligopoly. That economic moat we talked about, tech could eventually find ways around it.
Wow.
Fintech firms, other non-bank players, they're constantly innovating. They're finding smarter, often cheaper ways to grab market share in profitable niches, payments, wealth management, certain types of lending. They're chipping away at the edges of the fortress.
So the banks need to adapt or risk losing ground.
Absolutely. Their ability to adapt, to truly embrace innovation, maybe even acquire some of these fintechs, will be critical for defending their dominance over the long haul. It's not a minor threat. It's a fundamental challenge to how they've operated for decades.
And lastly, market risk. How do things like interest rate moves or currency swings affect them specifically?
This category mainly covers sensitivity to interest rates and foreign exchange, or FX. We already talked about how falling rates can squeeze net interest margins. While higher rates helped NIMs recently, a rapid, sustained drop could reverse that benefit pretty quickly.
And FX.
Foreign exchange risk is most significant for Scotiabank, TD, and BMO because they have such large operations outside Canada. Fluctuations in currencies like the US dollar or the Mexican peso can directly impact their reported earnings when translated back into Canadian dollars. A strong Canadian dollar, for instance, can make their foreign profits look smaller on paper.
Okay, so we've mapped out the stable foundation, the economic currents, the digital waves, but we keep talking about the big six like they're all the same. The reality is each one has its own distinct personality, its own strategy, its own set of risks and rewards.
Exactly. While they all benefit from that overall fortress structure, their individual strengths, how they've been performing lately, and where they're planning to go next, that really sets them apart. Let's quickly run through the key distinguishing features of each one.
Sounds good. Let's start at the top. Royal Bank of Canada, RBC.
Yeah.
Generally seen as the leader, the big blue chip of Canadian banking.
RBC really is the dominant force. Its sheer size isn't just impressive, it creates this self-reinforcing cycle. It holds the largest market share in almost every key area: retail banking, wealth management, capital markets, something like 21.9% share among the big five.
Biggest by market cap and assets too.
By far. Largest market cap, over $181 billion CAD, and assets over $2 trillion. This scale gives them huge economies of scale, better funding costs, a powerful brand, and an incredible customer loyalty. They consistently top JD Power surveys for advice satisfaction.
So they can reinvest more, solidifying their lead.
Precisely. It fuels more growth. And their business is incredibly diversified too. Personal and commercial banking is about 53% of earnings. The capital markets brings in 26%, and their leading wealth management arm adds another 16%.
Mostly Canada-focused.
Primarily Canada, but with a significant and growing presence in the U.S. and other key global centers. And that recent huge acquisition of HSBC Canada for $13.5 billion, that just cements their dominance at home. It adds around 780,000 clients, over $100 billion in assets. It's a massive long-term value play.
And how's their performance been? As steady as their reputation?
Remarkably consistent, high-quality earnings. That's their hallmark. For Q2 2024, they reported a strong adjusted return on equity, ROE, of 15.5%. That really shows their profitability and efficiency. Credit quality is solid, though provisions for losses are ticking up, like elsewhere.
And capital. Especially after buying HSBC.
Still very strong. Even after that massive deal, their CET1 ratio was a solid 12.8% in Q2 2024, well above the minimums.
Sounds like a very solid chip. How do they handle their capital? Give it back to shareholders, reinvest.
They have a very disciplined, very shareholder-friendly approach, a long, unbroken history of paying dividends. And growing them, they just raised it 3% in Q2 2024 to $1.42 Ameren share. Plus, they actively buy back their own shares, announced plans in May 2025 to buy back up to 35 million shares. That directly returns value to shareholders.
Okay, next up, Toronto Dominion Bank, TD, often seen as the cross-border powerhouse. huge in the U.S. retail market.
TD is indeed number two in Canada with about a 22.5% domestic share. But its real unique selling proposition, its key differentiator, is that massive, successful U.S. retail bank network all down the East Coast.
Makes them a big U.S. player, too.
Absolutely. Top 10 U.S. bank by assets. It gives them a unique growth path and important geographic diversification compared to the others. Plus, their big strategic investment in Charles Schwab gives them huge exposure to the U.S. wealth management market.
TD's had some very public, very expensive problems recently, hasn't it? Those regulatory issues in the U.S.
They certainly have. Their recent story has been overshadowed by these significant fines and provisions related to failures in their anti-money laundering, AML, controls in the U.S. We mentioned the $4.45 billion payment to the U.S. government.
Ouch.
It's led to leadership changes and, importantly, a regulatory cap on their U.S. retail asset growth. That's definitely going to hold back their U.S. ambitions in the near term.
Despite those serious issues, how's the underlying bank doing operationally?
Surprisingly solid, actually. In Q2 2025, TD reported adjusted earnings per share of $1.97, which actually beat expectations. It shows the core business is still resilient. Provisions for credit losses rose, like the others, to $1.34 billion.
And their capital, how did the fines impact that?
Critically, their capital position is exceptionally strong. Their CET1 ratio is way up at 14.9%. They strategically sold some of their Schwab shares, boosting their capital significantly. That gives them a massive buffer to handle future shocks or fund growth once these regulatory clouds lift.
So the long-term plan is still U.S. growth.
That remains the core strategy, expanding U.S. retail and commercial banking once they get the regulatory green light. And their recent acquisition of TD Cowen also significantly beefs up their U.S. investment banking capabilities.
And their capital allocation, given the compliance focus.
TD's always been a consistent dividend payer, $1.05 per share in Q2 2025. But right now, you have to assume a lot of capital and management attention is focused squarely on fixing the risk and compliance issues. Mm-hmm. So big M&A. Probably less likely until the AML problems are fully resolved. Internal fixes come first.
Okay, shifting gears to Bank of Nova Scotia, BNS, often called the international one, big presence in Latin America.
That's Scotiabank's key differentiator. As Canada's third largest, about 18.8% domestic share, its unique angle is that significant international footprint, especially in the Pacific Alliance countries, Mexico, Peru, Chile, Colombia.
Higher growth potential there.
That's the idea. Exposure to faster-growing emerging markets offers a compelling long-term story. But, and it's a big but, it also brings higher geopolitical risk, economic volatility, and currency fluctuations compared to the others who stick closer to North America.
And they're rethinking that strategy now.
They are. Under new leadership, they're undergoing a major strategic refresh to optimize that international footprint, focus on markets where they can really win, and improve overall profitability.
How has that international exposure impacted their recent results? Has it been tough?
Unfortunately, yes. Scotiabank's performance has lagged its peers recently, partly due to volatility in that international segment. This has led to their stock trading at a noticeable discount. In Q2 2025, their adjusted earnings per share, $1.52 term, missed estimates, mainly because provisions for credit losses jumped significantly to $1.4 billion.
Ouch. Any particular weak spots?
Their Canadian banking segment was actually particularly weak in that quarter, earnings down 31% year over year, which was surprising. Despite these issues, though, their capital remains strong, CET1 ratio of 13.2%.
So their future really depends on getting this strategic refresh right, focusing their international bets.
Absolutely. It means being disciplined, investing where they have an edge, and selling off non-core businesses. They've been divesting banking operations in places like Colombia, Costa Rica, Panama, to free up capital and simplify things.
Still returning cash to shareholders, though.
Yes. Despite the challenges, they remain committed. They recently raised their dividend 4% to $1.10 a share and announced a new 20 million share buyback. So they're trying to balance the turnaround with shareholder returns.
Next, Bank of Montreal, BMO. They've really pushed this idea of being an integrated North American bank.
This is BMO's clear strategy. Canada's fourth largest, about 13.4% domestic share. They want to be the bank that serves clients seamlessly across the Canada-U.S. border.
And the Bank of the West acquisition was key to that.
Transformative. It massively expanded their U.S. retail and commercial presence, especially into attractive markets like California. BMO already had strengths in commercial banking on both sides of the border, plus a well-regarded investment banking arm, BMO Capital Markets.
How's their performance looking with this bigger scale, especially in this economy?
Recent results show a mix. The benefits of scale are there, but so are the economic pressures. Their fiscal Q4 2024 saw adjusted net income fall due to a big jump in provisions for credit losses, up to $1.5 billion. But then Q2 2025 adjusted earnings, $2.62 share, beat expectations, even though PCLs stayed pretty high at $1.05 billion.
Full position.
Very strong. CET1 ratio of 13.6%. Their main growth driver now is successfully integrating Bank of the West, getting those cost savings and revenue synergies, and crucially, connecting their Canadian and U.S. operations better to cross-sell services.
And their approach to capital. They have that amazing dividend record.
All right. Incredible record. Longest running dividend payout of any company in Canada, 196 years. They just raised it again, 3% to $1.63 a share. They also plan to buy back up to 20 million shares. So a balanced approach. Reinvest for growth, but keep those dividends flowing.
Now, Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, CIBC,
yeah,
often seen as the most domestically focused, maybe a turnaround story.
CIBC is fifth largest, around 10.5% domestic share. And yes, among the big five, they have the highest concentration right here in the Canadian market.
Yeah.
That makes them very sensitive to how the Canadian economy, Canadian consumers, and the housing market are doing.
And they used to trade at a discount.
They did, historically, partly due to some past strategic mistakes and maybe a higher perceived risk profile. But under the current leadership, they've made really significant progress in de-risking the bank and strengthening the franchise.
Any particular strength?
One notable area is their digital banking platform. They consistently get top marks for client satisfaction with their mobile app. That's a key differentiator, especially with younger customers.
So is the financial performance reflecting this turnaround now? Are the numbers looking better?
They really are. CIBC has shown definite improvement. In Q2 2025, they posted a strong 15% increase in profit, and their adjusted earnings per share, $3.12, beat estimates. Solid results across the board. Provisions for credit losses went up to $1.42 billion, but that was pretty much in line with everyone else.
New capital.
Very strong. CET1 ratio ended fiscal 2024 at a robust 13.3%.
So clear signs of progress. What's their growth strategy moving forward? Still mainly Canada.
The core is deepening relationships with Canadian clients, especially focusing on growth segments like mass affluent customers and newcomers to Canada. They're also trying to leverage that digital leadership to attract younger people. But importantly, to diversify away from just Canada, they're also focused on expanding their U.S. commercial banking and wealth management businesses.
Makes sense. And their capital philosophy.
Disciplined. They target paying out 40% to 50% of their adjusted earnings as dividends. They have a consistent dividend record, just raised at 6 cents to $1.54 a share. Their main focus for capital seems to be funding that organic growth and maintaining a strong capital buffer.
Okay, last but not least, National Bank of Canada, NA. The sixth largest, often called the Quebec champion, but with surprising strength in capital markets and now making a big national move.
National Bank has a really unique and powerful position. While sixth overall, it absolutely dominates its home province of Quebec, giving it this incredibly stable and profitable base.
And the capital markets piece.
That's a key differentiator. Disproportionate to its size, it has a highly successful financial markets division. They're a major player in Canadian investment banking and trading. Historically, though, it was seen as more of a regional bank.
But that's changing.
Dramatically. They've embarked on this transformational national growth strategy with their big acquisition of Canadian Western Bank, CWB.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
How's that changed things? How's their performance been?
National Bank has a history of delivering superior profits, consistently higher ROE than the bigger banks. Q2 2025 continued that trend. Adjusted earnings per share, $2.85, beat expectations, driven again by strong capital markets results.
What about credit losses?
Provisions were $545 million. But importantly, that included a one-time initial provision of $230 million just for adding the CWB loan portfolio. So the underlying credit performance from their core business looks very strong. Capital remains robust too, CET1 at 13.4%, even after factoring in the CWB deal.
So CWB is the key to their national ambitions now.
It's the absolute central pillar. It gives them a huge platform for expansion, especially in Western Canada's commercial banking market. And crucially, it reduces their reliance on just Quebec and those sometimes volatile capital markets earnings.
Any other growth avenues?
They also pursue targeted international growth through two specialized units,
right.
Credigy, which is a U.S. specialty finance company, and ABA Bank in Cambodia, which is a leading digital bank in that high-growth Asian market. It helps diversify their income streams.
And their capital strategy.
Strong history of dividend growth, reflecting that high profitability. They just announced another 4-cent dividend increase to $1.18 a share. The CWB acquisition is obviously a huge strategic use of capital aimed at boosting long-term growth, but they're balancing that big investment with providing a steady, growing income stream to shareholders.
Wow, that's a lot of detail on each bank's unique path. To help listeners compare them quickly, let's maybe touch on some key metrics side by side. We've got data from late July 2025.
Good idea. Let's start with market cap and total assets, the basic measures of size. RBC, as we said, is the clear leader. Market cap over $181 billion CAD, assets over $2 trillion. TD is close behind on assets, almost $2 trillion. Market cap over $126 million.
And National Bank being smaller.
Considerably smaller, yeah. Market cap around $56 billion, assets around $355 billion. It really highlights that historically regional base, even with the CWB deal pushing them nationally.
Okay, what about those capital buffers we stressed earlier, the CET1 ratio?
Right, the CET1 ratio as of Q2 2025, super important for strength. TD actually stands out here with the highest ratio at 14.9%. That's an exceptionally strong buffer, especially important given their regulatory issues gives them huge flexibility.
Who else is strong?
BMO and National Bank are also very strong, 13.6% and 13.4%. The average for all six D-SIBs is a robust 13.6%. So bottom line, they are all operating well above the regulatory minimums. They really are those national shock absorbers.
How does the market value them? That's where price to book, PB ratio, and forward price to earnings, PE ratio, come in, right?
Exactly. The PB ratio compares the stock price to the bank's net asset value per share. RBC consistently gets the highest PB, around 2.07. That directly reflects the market giving it a premium for its consistency, diversification, market leadership.
Who else gets a premium?
National Bank is also high at 1.80, showing investor confidence in its high profits and growth story. TD and BNS are lower, 1.28 and 1.30 respectively. That often reflects their specific issues, TD's AML problems, BNS's international risks, and recent underperformance. The spread tells you how much extra investors will pay for $1 of their underlying assets.
And the forward PE ratio, looking at price versus expected future earnings.
Right, a forward-looking valuation. Lower PE can mean more attractive valuation or sometimes lower growth expectations. TD has the lowest forward PE here at 10.66. Combined with its super high CET1, that might suggest the market is undervaluing it due to the regulatory overhang.
An opportunity, perhaps.
Potentially, for investors who believe TD can fix its problems and get back on track, National Bank has the highest PE at 13.73, again reflecting its strong profit track record and growth prospects. The average for the big six is around 12.54.
What about income investors? Dividend yield is usually key for them.
Indeed. Bank of Nova Scotia, BNS, offers the highest yield right now at 5.81%. Very attractive for income seekers. But remember their lower ROE. Sometimes a high yield signals higher perceived risk or challenges holding the stock price down.
And the lowest yield.
National Bank at 3.29%. Typically because its stock price has performed well relative to its dividend payments, reflecting capital growth and reinvestment.
And finally, return on equity, ROE. How well are they actually using shareholders' money to make profits, a measure of management skill?
Exactly. National Bank really shines here. Highest ROE at 16.27% shows superior profitability and efficiency. RBC and TD are also strong, 14.09% and 14.73%. Excellent capital use. BNS has the lowest at 7.91%, which again lines up with its recent struggles, especially in those international markets weighing down returns. Looking at these metrics together really helps you understand not just what the banks are doing, but how well they're doing it and what the market thinks about their future.
Okay, so we've profiled each bank, compared their stats. Now let's zoom back out. How should we think about the valuation and risk of these banks as a whole group?
Assessing the valuation of Canadian banks really requires looking through a few different lenses. You compare them against each other domestically, you look at their own history, how they've traded in the past, and maybe most interestingly, you compare them to banks internationally, especially in the U.S.
And the differences within the big six. Why does RBC get a premium while others trade at a discount?
Right now, those differences are mostly driven by the market's view on each bank's specific growth prospects and its unique risk profile. RBC's premium, that's earned through consistent results, scale, market leadership. You see it in that high price-to-book ratio.
And the discounts for, say, Scotiabank or CIBC?
For Scotiabank, it reflects the perceived higher risk and recent weaker performance of its international strategy. For CIBC, it's historically been about its heavy concentration in Canada and maybe some memory of past issues. These valuation gaps aren't random. They represent the market's collective judgment on the risk versus reward for each bank's strategy and situation.
Okay, and how do they look compared to U.S. banks? We always hear about this Canadian premium. Is that still a thing?
It absolutely is. Historically, and still today, Canadian banks command a significant valuation premium over U.S. regional banks, and even some larger U.S. banks.
And that premium is justified. Why?
It's justified by those fundamental structural advantages we talked about right at the start. The oligopoly limits competition. The stricter regulations enforce stability. And that combination has historically led to higher and much more stable returns on equity compared to many U.S. banks.
So if you compare their valuation multiples now?
If you compare current P.E. or P.B. ratios for the Big Six against U.S. peers like PNC, Truist, U.S. Bancorp names, often used for comparison, that premium for the Canadian banks is still clearly there. Its exact size moves around with the economy and sentiment, but the core premium persists.
So for our listener, thinking about current valuations, what's the key takeaway? Are they cheap? Expensive.
Across the sector, current valuations seem, well, reasonable. They reflect the economic uncertainties we've discussed, the trade worries, the slower growth. They aren't deeply discounted, which suggests investors should probably focus more on the potential for long-term total return.
Total return meaning?
Meaning a combination of steady earnings growth plus that reliable, growing dividend stream. It's probably not realistic to expect a big surge just from valuation multiples expanding in the near term. This isn't typically a sector for quick, explosive gains. It's more about consistent compounding returns over time. #... outro.
All right, as we wrap up this really comprehensive deep dive, let's try to pull it all together. What's the core story, the fundamental tension we should take away about Canada's Big Six banks today?
The core thesis, I think, revolves around this crucial tension. You have this incredibly strong economic moat and unmatched regulatory stability on one side.
The fortress.
The fortress, exactly. Versus these very real near-term economic headwinds trades, slowing growth, and the persistent long-term challenge of digital disruption on the other side. They are protected structurally in ways few global banks are, which makes them exceptionally resilient.
So looking further out, say the next 5 to 10 years, what does the long-term outlook suggest for them?
The long-term outlook is generally seen as one of continued stability and moderate, consistent growth. That powerful oligopoly structure, reinforced by those high regulatory walls, isn't expected to crumble anytime soon.
So they should keep making good profits.
That structure should ensure they continue to generate strong profits and attractive returns on equity. The main long-term challenge, really, is navigating that technological disruption we discussed. Success will depend on how well each bank uses AI and data to genuinely improve customer experiences, streamline how they work, and boost efficiency, all while managing the huge costs of staying technologically current.
And given that Canada's a mature market, growth outside the country seems vital too.
Absolutely critical. A big chunk of future growth for most of them has to come from outside Canada. So those North American expansion strategies we talked about for TD, BMO, RBC, even CIBC, they are crucial. How well they execute those plans, leveraging their Canadian stability in new markets, that will be a key differentiator in performance over the next decade.
Okay, so for our listener, weighing all this up, what are the key investment considerations if they're thinking about Canadian bank stocks for their portfolio?
Well, if your goals are stability, reliable, and hopefully growing income and moderate long-term capital growth, then Canadian bank stocks often represent a core holding. Think of them as anchor tenants in a diversified portfolio.
Why anchor tenants?
Because of that incredibly long history of uninterrupted dividends, many over 150 years. That makes them ideal for income investors. And that fortress balance sheet, that protective regulation, it provides significant downside support. It might limit the explosive upside compared to riskier sectors, but it cushions the downside.
And if someone is looking to invest, how might they choose among the Big Six based on everything we've discussed? Can we create a quick choice matrix?
We can try. For maximum stability and quality, RBC is the clear blue chip, offering broad diversification and market leadership, but you pay a premium valuation for it.
Okay. What if you want North American exposure?
For balanced North American exposure, TD and BMO offer significant and growing U.S. footprints, blending Canadian stability with U.S. growth potential. Though TD comes with that near-term regulatory question mark.
Higher risk, higher reward.
For potentially higher risk, but also higher reward, especially internationally, Scotiabank offers that unique Latin American exposure. It brings more volatility, but greater long-term potential if their strategic turnaround works.
What about a pure Canadian bet?
For the most concentrated play on a Canadian economic recovery, CIDC, with its heavy domestic focus, gives you the most direct exposure to the Canadian consumer and housing market. It's also a potential turnaround story.
And the unique profile.
And finally, for that unique combination of regional strength in Quebec plus that strong capital markets arm, National Bank offers a history of top-tier profitability and now has this exciting national growth story unfolding with the CWB acquisition.
That's a great summary. So as a final thought for our listeners to chew on, technology is relentlessly reshaping every single industry. And we have the real-time rail and open banking finally coming closer in Canada. So consider this. Will those fortress walls around Canada's Big Six truly hold firm against these new digital tides? Or will innovation eventually find ways to carve new paths right through their historic economic moat? What specific parts of their current strategies, like their big bets on AI or those ambitious international expansions, what do you think will be most critical for them to maintain their dominance in the decade ahead?